Accession number 28698, Reel 12.
Major Lawton, Reel 12. You were talking about the lad being shot.
Yeah, he'd had his dream, he'd had his premonition, and 20 minutes into the patrol, I saw one of the Dickens system with his red and black lumberjack shirt on. And apart from that, it was nearly 7:30 in the morning, it was pouring a rain, and he was trying to read a newspaper, and the newspaper was upside down. I know that sounds Irish, but that's exactly what he was doing. I alerted the patrols that the Dickens system was out, something would happen. It was acknowledged, and within, later in that patrol, Roberts was shot dead from 75 yards, from a gate hanging on one hinge, and the gunman couldn't be seen. He was in a little V-sign. Had Roberts been 2 feet to the left or right, he wouldn't have been shot. He was, and it came across the radio that it was me. It had been Blondie Lawton that was shot. I came on the radio, 5-6 Charlie speaking. It is not me. I'm chasing the gunman. And I was, as we were chasing the gunman down towards Corpus Christi Church, which is the area where we lost him, actually. One of my guys in my section had frozen with the shooting and had hidden in the back alleyway of one of the trees, and his nerves had got the better of him. I had to run in the alley, grab hold of him and chuck him back on the street. I chuck it out of him, and he was all right to follow on while we continued chasing the gunman. The gunman physically got away at that particular stage. The company was alerted, and the QRF bomb burst onto the area. We surrounded the church and the area where we thought the gunman had gone, but we lost him. We were all called back to the camp. We all went back into the Moyard camp. The anti-tanks, because it was our patrol and our man who had been shot dead, we were taken off the streets and told that we had to go on guard in case our tempers were frayed and we might take actions that we wouldn't normally do. And the mortars and the recce platoon with the buglers went out, and they did a full cordon and a search of the whole area. It was obvious when the crowd gathered at a certain area on the estate where the gunmen were actually hiding in what houses. And I've already mentioned you could go in number 5, run along an alleyway and jump out in number 9, where this particular street was known for having the mouse holes up in the attics. So cordons were put on either side. The gunman, James Emerson Bryson, a famous gunman who'd been responsible for the death of many, many policemen and soldiers and Marines and paras, etc., was caught, was captured. The crowd overwhelmed the patrol on the ground, and it's believed that the mother of the gunman did some bodily injury to the young lieutenant who physically had his hands on the gunman. Left gore, the gunman disappeared in the crowd, not to be seen again. And got him. The search continued throughout the whole of the Sunday, and the gunmen were not recaptured again. And the crowd stayed on the street to hamper any operations carried out by our company. So we'd lost the gunmen at that particular stage.
And could you bring nothing against the mother and some of the crowd that you couldn't arrest them?
There was just overwhelming odds. There was hundreds and hundreds of them, and you had your normal sections. You get swallowed up, and it is not a situation where you can have 8 men stranded by thousands of people. You won't come out of it alive. Anyway, the searches were on for arrests and everything else, and life went on in different parts of the province. In fact, it was shortly after that that young Powers, a young soldier in Air Company down in the Clonard, physically got shot as well, but not dead. And then that was on the 1st of July, and then on the 19th of July, of course, 7 pirate officers were captured by one of our, by the people of our B company. And lo and behold, one of them was actually Jerry Adams, who was, we knew was OC, the Belfast Battalion, if not OC, the Belfast Brigade. But him and 6 others were captured after a long cordon, and again, churches were involved in this again, and they were arrested and taken away to Springfield Road Police Station. So far on that tour, apart from the people we shot, we'd had 13 of our battalion wounded. But we had a brilliant doctor at the time who attended every gunshot wound on the streets and the hospitals and everything else. And every one of them men pulled round, and there was no severe damage from any of them.
What was the name of the doctor?
I do know his name, but I can't think of it at this particular moment. If you don't mind, I'll come back and tell you at a later time.
Can I just ask you, before you go on, what role was the... You talked about Bambi search churches and so forth, so the
No, we weren't allowed to search churches. We could call them...
They were being involved, in a sense. They were boat holes, escape holes, what have you.
There were sensitive negotiations that were going on between the police and the local church and everybody else to say, we know they're in there, because they were saying going in, they haven't come out. And again, political sensitivity and the church sensitivity would prevail... and situations would be sorted out by negotiation. Jerry Adams and them weren't caught in the church, actually, but they were caught in having a meeting in the back of one of the houses where intelligence had pointed the company in the right direction. It was a significant find for our battalion.
Did you know, by this time, Adams by name or reputation?
We knew who he was and what he was, but not his reputation was not that then, what it is now, of course.
So I'm thinking in terms of his reputation with the IRA rather than as a politician. As
we didn't realise he was that high up on the IRA, of course, and he denies ever being in the IRA, let alone his position in the IRA, but, I mean, that's for the powers to be. I mean, there was great television coverage on the arrest because he was in Springfield Road police station. And, of course, the cameras covered it where there was a massive armoured convoy to take him away, to be locked up permanently. And it was only his wife, I think, when the crowd dispersed, still stayed outside the police station and said, I know he's not in that convoy. And, of course, he wasn't. He went out hours and hours later. But I think you can't say much more about that one.
I was just going to say, suppose captured with other... So officers of the IRA who, presumably, again, they would have reputations of being...
Yes, they were.
It's a bit obvious that he couldn't claim he wasn't a member of the IRA.
No, not at all. That makes me wonder today why he's in the position he's in, but there you have it. That's not for me to say. The tour again was coming to the end. We still hadn't captured Robbie's murderers. Like I said, we'd arrested 200 other people and other arrests were going on and committals to court were still going on. We were then preparing to hand over to the Green Jackets, one of our sister regiments. I'd been back in OPs again, overlooking the Bull Ring and the Ballymurphy, knowing that the gunmen would come back, because they always come back. But our tour was coming to an end, so we had to hand over the position. And the Green Jackets later went in that same OP, in the Bull Ring, and sure enough, Mulvenna and Bryson came back, brandishing their arms, drove through the Ballymurphy three times, and on the third time were hit by the army, mortally wounded, and later died. So that ended that chapter.
So we got them in the end?
We got them in the end. That particular tour, we had very few incidents as we're handing over to the Green Jackets. They were put well... In the picture of the area they were taking over, and that there was gunmen and bombers out there at every street corner. We then got on the ferries and came back to UK and back to Colchester, knowing that the rest of that year would be on our normal training and a posting to Germany in the start of the next year.
You returned to Ireland on what day?
The next route for London, really, was the whole battalion was in situ by the 18th of March of 75. And we're coming in when the IRA were just calling a ceasefire, believe it or not. And we were asked to have a low-profile patrolling and do more hearts and minds in among the people and not aggressive patrolling. Well, as a battalion, we took that with a pinch of salt. And we never exactly took our high alertness down a peg at all, although we tried to relax more as we patrolled. And for the first tour, we wore our silver cap badges instead of black cap badges. So for the first tour ever, since the troubles began, we walked around with our green berets on and silver cap badges. And it's funny, the ceasefire was holding in a sense, although there was incidents going on. But for the first three, nearly 4 months,
No shots were fired at us as a battalion, and we fired no shots at anybody else. But we patrolled Christ extensively, but in a quieter manner, although it was aggressive in our minds that we were always on the alert that we were going to get shot at. It was very unnerving for us who'd already done 4 and 5 tours, and it was a false sense of security for young soldiers doing their first tours, because they thought, well, what's all this about? There's nothing happening. We haven't been shot at. And yet the older soldiers have been saying, oh, we used to get shot at 17 times a day. So they didn't believe the stories, but it was very unnerving for us who'd been there several times before.
Did this affect the way the civilians were responding to you as well during this period?
Well, yes. Again,
they warmed to you?
We were trying to win them over by more hearts and minds, but knowing at the same time the sympathisers were still dicking on us. IRA were still moving weapons about and planting bombs, except none of them were going off. We knew the EEC referendum was coming up, because even as us as soldiers, our officers had come round and told us that we all must vote for the referendum, no matter what, and we all had to go in a building and have the secret vote. But it would be more difficult for the civilian population, because depending on what the IRA wanted them to do, and in fact the UDA and the UVF wanted their Protestants to do, we would have to guard the polling stations to make it fair and even, so people wouldn't be frightened off about voting in the EEC referendum. But what the referendum did, and the polling stations, and the amount of soldiers, because more soldiers were brought into the province to guard the polling stations, rioting started again. Because the people saw more troops, they thought were more aggressive, the IRA were telling people not to vote, people wanted to vote, we were having to do with the gardening, so we were having to put a bigger presence on the ground. So the rioting started again. But the government had said, whatever you do, keep your low profile, don't upset the population, let the referendum and the voting go on. And as military, don't do anything to upset it. But all the time we were doing this, we're actually targeting people who were instigating the riots, who were causing the trouble, who were fetching people on the street. So we had a target list of 6 targets up by the end of the riot and the voting. And then we actually went in and started making the arrests. And we did arrest 5 of the top people out of the 6 targets that we'd been allotted as the troublemakers. But we did it after the voting was all over. So politically, we kept the profile as low as possible.
Were any of the well-known people amongst the 5 that you arrested?
They were the ones that the intelligence sources had said that we had to arrest. And that's what we went out and arrested.
Any problems with arresting them?
Yes, there was. Every time you have an arrest, the people come on the streets and try to block you, as they did in 73, and will try and take the prisoners away from you. In this case, they didn't, and we got away with it. We had to up the ante a little bit and be a little bit more aggressive than what we'd done for 3 months, trying to look casual walking around the streets. But we kept it at an even keel, and we didn't get too much hassle from the people at all until about the last week. But one of the incidents I would like to tell you about was I was out on patrol at late at night, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night, and we heard people digging, and we knew people were still digging arms in and hiding explosives. So we stayed behind this garden fence till we thought the digging was finished, and we heard voices saying, ah, got it. We looked over the fence, and there was people in the back garden pulling green greaseproof bags out of the ground. We dived over the fence to arrest them. It wasn't arms that they were digging up, it was actually poutine, which again was illegal to keep and hide and have on your property. And it had been buried a couple of feet underground, as you do with poutine.
What's poutine, by the way? It's
illegally stilled spirits. So we told the person that they would have to be they were under arrest anyway, because it was illegal to still and hold poutine. They said, well, before we got arrested and got too carried away, would we like a drink? Poutine, if you don't know, will take your eyesight, your mind and everything else. So 1 minute, we're carrying these little pocket tape recorders to tape people's conversations, unknown to them, of course. And I was doing this with a clear mind. By the time I got back to camp to give this to the intelligence section,
there was some rebel songs on it, and my soldiers were talking incoherently. And of course, this hangs on to another day when you start and drink water or any liquids, and it takes your speech away again. And that's exactly what happened. I was clear of mind and clear of speech. Some of my soldiers were not.
And was there a problem for this? I mean, what happened to the when it got back and the officers saw this happening? Did they?
Well, he warned me that what we'd done was illegal. I said, if you listen to the story, I'll tell you what's happening on the estates. Sent the men away, and he said, come back next morning. I went back next morning, give the debrief to the intelligence section, still clear and coherent. Halfway through, I had a cup of tea, and my speech went. And they went, bloody hell, I would disappear before anybody else sees you. And later in the day, I had cleared up. But every time my blokes had something to drink, their speech completely went. Hence the power of this poor chain.
Can I just ask you again about hearts and minds? You must be having conversations, with people. What kind of thing did you say to people to get into their hearts and their minds?
Well, every conversation would always start, name, address, date of birth, where you're from, what you're doing here. Do you know of any illegal operations going on in your estate? That was the straightforward questions you asked everybody. If they wanted to elaborate and start mumbling and saying, no, but I would like to talk about something that's going on, this, you would follow their lead, their conversation. And of course, there was always, if you could get a friendly talk going and you knew they had more to say and they wanted to say, you could always arrange to either go and search their house so you could speak to them in private at their house, or even arrest them if you want to fetch them into the base and debrief them inside a secure base. Or you could get them to meet and come into a base unbeknown to their neighbours and anybody else. And again, they would go in soundproof rooms and you would record what they had to say. Then whatever they said would be followed up.
Were there many of these? Were they coming forward?
Yes, there were. You would always get the odd one. Some were targeted. And by targeted, I mean it could be a person in the IRA who you knew you could turn for reasons. And of course, there was various reasons: money, sex, revenge, any other thing that you think somebody wants to
reveal through intelligence, presumably.
Through intelligence. And yes, if you could get a conversation going with a person and you say, would you like to come into an army base and tell us more? Or like I said, you say, right, I'll arrange that I've got to come and search your house. And then you take them in and talk to them in their own rooms.
Was there any element, again, in hearts and minds, which when you tried to show the civilian person or people that you were human beings, you had families and this kind of chat?
That's exactly what we used to say. I could say, look, I'm a young man with two children, less than school age, just like your two children that I can see in your little beds and prams and one thing or another. And the conversation could go that way and people would respond as normal human beings. Well, you've got to remember, 90% of the people are normal, although they depend on which estate they live in, they may have their sympathies to one cause or another. But they themselves are not criminals, they are not terrorists, they are nothing. They are normal people who know people who are not normal people. The fact that they want to tell you or not is up to them. And some people want to, for a variety of reasons. Some just want to live their own lives and keep out of it altogether.
What about the UDA and the UDF? Did you come across the actions against them in any way? Did you?
Well, you've got the UDA and the UVF, and if you're in the Shankill or any of the other Protestant estates, you come across them just like you come across the IRA. And they are doing equally illegal, dishonest activities as the IRA. And if you know how they're doing this, they get arrested, same as the IRA or any other criminal.
Were they firing on you as well? Were you being sniped?
No, not anymore. Although you get the odd shot if you were getting too close to somewhere where they didn't want you to be, they would make it known that you weren't welcome. But like I said before, the British Army and the government couldn't fight on two fronts. You couldn't take the Protestants and the Catholics on all at the same time. And the main enemy was the IRA, so you had to concentrate on the IRA.
What other memories have you got of this particular tour?
Well, like I say, it was the quietest tour. In fact, at one stage, because we'd been on all the tours where it was high intensity training, high intensity operations. This was high intensity training, low intensity operations. And to us, we would say it is boring. And they said it was a disillusionment to the people going there for the first time, wondering what all this hard hitting murder and IRA was all about, because they weren't getting any of it. However, when it came to the last week, the IRA did want to say farewell to us in their own way, because we'd started to get aggressive after the elections to arrest these targeted people that we needed to arrest. So in the last couple of days before we left, we had several shootings and three bombs against us, and that was their way of saying bye-bye to Ally out of Londonderry. Although we weren't leaving the province, we were going down to Belfast, because it was July now, and we were going down there to help the Scots Guards and two para out with the marching season. So we went down there, we got billeted with the units that we were going to help, and I was with the paras, and we went in and we patrolled the streets of Belfast through the night. And then on the 12th came, when you get thousands and thousands of orange men on the streets, we were there with them to put the interface up between the Catholics and the Protestants. And what you used to do is get your Bedford trucks, and they'd have great big massive screens on that you would fold out, just Hessian and a pipework. But you'd put them back to back to back to back, and it would literally block the street off, so the Catholics couldn't see this way, and the Protestants wouldn't be throwing bottles and bricks and petrol bombs at the Catholic houses. Although the Catholics would be chucking bricks over the top to land on the Protestants who were marching by. And then you would get the hundreds of people marching, the people in the bowler hats and the orange sashes and the umbrellas, and then each one preceded by their own local band. And they would march through the Catholic estates, through the Protestant estates, through the Catholic estates, through the Protestant estates, and we were there physically, one, to try and count the people, and you were taught how to count in blocks. So you could measure a 50-person block or a 100-person block, and you would keep a tally, 100, 200, 300, 400, 500, 600, 1,000, 2,000, to try and estimate how many people were physically marching. Other people were there and trained with their photographs to work out who was leading all these people, so you could see if there were UDA, UVF or whatever. So there was lots of different people doing lots of different things, and then there'd be Corvette cameras going off and photographing these people. So if somebody of the Orange Lodge said, oh, I've got nothing to do with the UDA, UVF, so and then here you are in your umbrella, your orange sash, and we know you're in the UDA and the UVF. So there was lots of intelligence gathering all the time. But the main thing was, for us, is the supporting battalion who had come down from Londonderry. It actually would come down by train. For the first time ever, they put soldiers on a train, and we came from Londonderry to Belfast on trains. But I must admit, there was battalions all the way from Londonderry to guarding the railway line. But again, it was a bit of hearts and mind, and to try and get people to use the trains and that again, our whole battalion travelled from down back to into Belfast by train, which was a novelty.
And the marches themselves, again, were they frightening? I mean, you're like pig in the middle again, aren't you?
The noise is, because they have the big drumbeg drums, and all the music is, in a way, aggressive. Because remember, it's William of Orange fighting the Catholics, and it's there to instill fear into the Catholic population, and it certainly does that. We now know a lot of Catholics will take their holidays in July of the 12th week, and they would leave the country. But yes, their marches are impressive, they are frightening, they are noisy, but they are brilliant and colourful. And the skills of the bands people and the baton twirlers and that is phenomenal. And it's you need to watch it to understand it. It's absolutely brilliant. But when they're all banging the drums and they're all shouting, scary.
What kind of things are they shouting?
Well, it's all to good do with the tunes and all the rest of it. Oh. It really is. You need to see it to believe it. And to be in among it is both exciting and frightening.
So to the Catholics, it's not quite the same as having one of your little once a year annual affairs at parades you get in England. I mean, they see it as what it is, an aggression. And
they know it's coming. They know what they're doing. And it's really them now who antagonise it. They ask the police to put roads out of bounds, streets out of bounds, this out of bounds, knowing that the Protestants will say you are now infringing on our freedom to march through our streets that we pay our council taxes for. So really they antagonise the situation. If they let it happen and just let them get away with it, they would just walk through, come out the other end, and that would be it.
So that was your first experience, was it, of
Previous Belfast tours. If you were there in Ireland in July, you will invariably be part of the 12th of July marches. Yeah.
And you're on duty, as you say, of keeping them away from...
Yeah.
Or trying to keep them out
of... You're trying to stop the Catholics and the Protestants getting into each other. But those bricks and bottles will come sailing over the barricades. But the fact that you're keeping thousands to that side of the fence and thousands to this side of the fence does pay off.
So what happened next?
Well, at the end of that was it for that particular tour. So we literally then came back to where Lemgo